is not lost for the Dodgers, but the pitching's pretty rough. So now, Michael Duarte of NBC LA is joining us. This was kind of a rough night for the Dodgers, but I want to start with fans throwing stuff on the field. Dave Roberts says he's never seen anything like that before. What's your experience in LA?
Yeah, it was a great segue as far as the bad stuff goes. Dave Roberts said, I was in that press conference room after the game, that he'd been to over 1,000 Dodger games, obviously, as a coach for 9 seasons, as a player before that. He'd never seen anything like that. I've never seen anything like it as far as the 2 to 3 dozen security cards that came on the field, the nearly 10-minute delay for everything in the middle of a playoff game right after the seventh inning stretch. But I have seen, we can go all the way back, Amy, to the Barry Bonds era with fans throwing inflatable steroid pills at Bonds. And this has kind of been a thing with rivals and Dodger fans for years. And it goes to the other team's fans as well, the opposing team's fans, whether it's the Giants or in this case the Padres. When a rivalry is this intense, when it's the postseason and emotions are high and liquor is flowing in this stadium, something as playful and innocent as a home run robbery by Jerks and Profar in the bottom of the first inning that would have tied the game and some jawing back and forth from between fans, can kind of, it's like a ticking time bomb that as that jawing continues and the making fun and throwing balls into the crowd and vice versa begins to go, and then the game begins to kind of get out of reach, and now your team is losing and the other team is taunting and provoking, then it's like lighting that fuse, lighting that match, and this thing can explode. And I think that's what we saw happen in the seventh inning at Chavez Ravine on Sunday night.
I know that as drama goes and fun storylines and just great back and forth, it's nice to have two teams who know each other well. That whole, you know, familiarity breeds contempt. And these two teams are both so familiar. The fan bases are so intertwined there. However, I'm wondering, and this is just your opinion, of course, Michael, from the Dodgers' perspective, do you think they would have preferred to see anybody else except for the Padres, considering how well San Diego played against them this year?
I mean, if I talk to the players, say Oscar Hernandez is one guy that said this was the team he wanted. Miguel Rojas told me he wanted the Padres too. I think. Look, if you're looking at it purely from a on paper perspective, no, not necessarily. But this is baseball. You know, I was just joking with friends today. 2 years ago in 2022, I thought there was no way the Padres would get past the Mets in the wild card when they were throwing Jacob deGrom and Scherzer out there in those first two games. But yet they survived that and then stunned the 111-win Dodgers. And now we're looking for a setup like where it could be the exact same thing. It could be deja vu here again in 2024. The Dodgers, if you recall, won the first game of that series and then lost the next three, including getting swept the 2 games at Petco Park. And if you're looking at it on paper, the pitching matchups with Michael King and Walker Buehler in Game 3 and then probably 2 bullpen games in Game 4, it could potentially be setting up for a similar situation here this year. So yes, especially with a lot of baseball analysts predicting that the Padres were the most well-balanced team. I also think the Padres are the most well-balanced team, top to bottom with the lineup. They have guys who can hit for average. They have guys that can slug and power from both sides of the plate, as you saw tonight with the 6 home runs, which, by the way, Amy, that is the most the Dodgers have allowed in a playoff game in franchise history. And that goes all the way back to the 1880s when they were the Brooklyn Bridegrooms. So 6 home runs in a playoff game,
sorry,
the most all-time for the Dodgers. And this team could also hit for average with Luis Arias, obviously, the batting champion. Jerks and Profar, another guy. The bullpen is amazing. The defense, as you saw today, was on full display for the Padres, robbing home runs, diving catches, leaping catches. Anytime the Dodgers thought they had maybe a rally going, it was snuffed out by that Padres' excellent defense. So top to bottom, I think they're the most well-balanced team right now, still in the tournament. And that's why a lot of people predicted that they could go to the World Series this year. And I'm on that same exact train. But the last thing I'll say to your question, I think tonight's game in Game 2 played perfectly into the Padres' script. Guys like Manny Machado, Fernando Tatis Jr., Profar, obviously what you saw in the beginning, they want to be the villains. Manny Machado went out there and gambled his entire $300 million contract that the Padres would win the World Series before the Dodgers when he switched from blue to brown in 2019. Obviously, he lost that gamble. But he's been a provoker for years of the Dodgers fan base. Just there during this last homestand when the Padres turned that triple play started by him to win and clinch a postseason berth, he said after the game he was surprised that Dodgers fans didn't leave early, and then he said their probation must have been extended. So he's an instigator in all of this. Tatis is an instigator in all this. There's videos, if you look on social media tonight, of him thrusting his pelvic at them and gyrating and doing the fake tears, and he's an instigator in all this. They want the villain. They want all the smoke and the heat. They kind of want these things thrown at them. Fans should never do that. You should never throw anything at the players. This is not the Malice at the Palace, but they want all that negative attention. They're feeding off of it, and I think it played right into it. The Dodgers fans played right into it tonight. And the last thing I'll say about it, too, is this all started, and really that fuse got lit when Jack Flaherty hit Fernando Tatis to start off the fourth inning. Manny Machado started jawing at him. He then struck out Manny Machado, and then Jack Flaherty gave it back to him, told him to go sit down with an expletive. After that, they were jawing at each other, and Manny Machado threw a baseball at the Dodgers dugout. That pissed off all the guys in the dugout. That got Flaherty on the top step, telling him he would fight him and they should go meet out back after the game. That really kind of ignited
men.
This. And I think exactly. Men, testosterone, emotions, playoff baseball. I really think the Dodgers might have poked the bear here in the Padres because they didn't play like this in game one. And now they got all the momentum going to game three.
Michael Duarte is with us after that game at Chavez Ravine where the Padres take it on the back of 6 home runs and a lot of jawing, a lot of fireworks. And now the series is tied as they head to San Diego for game 3. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. What's the status of Freddie Freeman?
Yeah, you asked the same thing. I know essentially as much as you do, but I do have the behind the scenes of seeing him prepare for the last few days for this series. I mean, he's been shot up. He's very medicated. But every day, whether it was the workout on Friday or Thursday, where I saw him running sprints, testing it, running from first to third, doing it again before the game on Saturday before game one, everything seemed pretty positive. Like he was going to be able to play through the pain and give it a go. And then he tried to play possum and steal a base, which he successfully did in game one, Amy. But if you watch the replay, that wasn't much of a slide. It was a collision with the base. It's his right ankle that he has that high ankle sprain on, and that got caught in the bag on it. I think that re-aggravated the injury a little bit, probably caused some more pain. He tried to play through it tonight. He couldn't do it. And what I would say is telling, Amy, is when he came out in that sixth inning, he was due up third in the bottom half of the inning, meaning he could have tried to push through and at least go to the plate in the bottom half of the inning and then maybe come out knowing maybe that's his last at-bat of the night. And he didn't do it. And that tells me something about Freddie Freeman really having to have a lot of pain on that ankle because this guy's played through a broken finger this season, and to come out like that is frustrating. Now, the good news is you have an off day in between, so he can get treatment all day tomorrow, doesn't have to put weight on it, can do what they call rice, you know, rest, elevate, ice, heat, whatever he can, and see how he feels before the game on Tuesday. But that's not a good sign yet to come out, and it could be a bad sign for the Dodgers here moving forward.
The Dodgers pitching has been their weakness all season long. That rotation has gone through, I don't know how many iterations. It feels like dozens of them. Jack Flaherty, he gets hit pretty hard, but it's not just him. It's the bullpen, too. How does the pitching stack up now, starting with game 3?
Yeah, I mean, the Dodgers have actually had 20 different starting pitchers this season. That is just mind-blowing when a normal starting rotation is 5, but 20 this year. How does it stack up behind Flaherty? Look, this Dodgers team knew that their strong suit would be the bullpen. They don't necessarily have 3 all-star guys in the back end of the pen like the Padres do, but they got 5 or 6 really solid guys, high-leverage guys, guys that they trust, guys that can go left-on-left matchups like Alex Vesia. They got guys who can throw 100 miles per hour like their new incumbent closer who they acquired at the deadline from the White Sox and Michael Kopech. They got Blake Treinen, who you saw come out and do a 5-out save. Daniel Hudson, their closer, who was the closer all of last season and the first half of the season, and Evan Phillips, who has a nasty sweeper slider. They got a lot of different looks, pitches, and things they can throw, and they just want to get through 4 or 5 innings through their starters, hopefully scoreless or at least, you know, unscathed that much, 1 run at best, and then get to the pen and throw out all these weapons at them. The good news for the Dodgers is they didn't really use any of the guys except for Ryan Brazier, that they used in game one. So all these guys are going to have some extra rest now to be ready to go for games three and four if they're called upon, which I think they will be. And the guys, this game got out of hand late, but it was guys like Michael Grove, Enriquez, which these are guys you're not going to see through the postseason. These are guys who were literally on the playoff roster for mop-up duty. And so the high-leverage arms will be ready to go in game three. They need Walker Buehler to turn back the clock, Amy, to look like that 2018, 19, even should I say 20 and 21 Walker Buehler. That was probably their best big game pitcher. Hmm. They need him to come out. I know he can't throw 100 miles per hour anymore coming off of two Tommy John surgeries, but the last time he took the mound for the Dodgers was in that crucial game against the Padres where they needed to clinch the NL West. He went out there and gave a great performance. He needs to do that again. They don't need him to go deep. Like Darvish went seven today. They don't need him to do that. In fact, the last quality start by a Dodgers starter in the postseason was Max Scherzer in the 2021 wild card game against the Cardinals, if you can believe that, Amy.
Whoa.
They just don't let the pitchers go that deep anymore. So
right.
If Walker Buehler can give them five, that's exactly what they need. And if he can keep them close with Michael King, who's been excellent for the Padres this year in his first year as a starter, then I think that bodes well if it goes the bullpen to bullpen and the Dodgers have a lead or close. I think it bodes well for them and plays into their playbook and their strong suit if that was the case in game three.
Michael, just a few seconds before we pivot a little bit to football, but going back to Saturday night, Shohei Ohtani blasts his first career postseason home run. We've waited 10 years, not quite 10, we've waited 8 years to see him on this stage, and he comes through with that huge moment that ties the game and, of course, propels the Dodgers to the opening win. What was that like inside Dodger Stadium?
Oh, my gosh, Amy. It's like, first of all, Shohei Ohtani in the playoffs is like this library book that's been sitting on my desk for years. It's long overdue. I am so glad we finally get to see the best player in baseball in the postseason.
Only you, Michael. Only you.
Thank you. Thank you. And what I want to say is I read a stat the other day. The Dodgers were like 0-for-20 when down by 3 runs or more after the first inning. They'd never been able to come back and win a game. But, of course, they never had Shohei Ohtani. And I think for Dodgers fans, going down 3-0 early after that 2-run home run by Manny Machado on Yamamoto in the first inning, we're hearing that maybe he was tipping his pitches, and that is out there. But Ohtani erases it all with one swing in the bottom of the second, pronounces himself on the October stage, and essentially, as I wrote in my Game 1 story, does what he's been doing all year long, and that is be the superstar, be the hero. He loves those dramatic moments. We saw it in the World Baseball Classic when he won for Team Japan, the Samurai, striking out Mike Trout. He lives for these moments. He's not intimidated by him. He's not nervous, as he said in his pregame press conference. And I watched him when he stepped into the box for his very first at-bat in the bottom of the first inning. He looked calm as a cucumber. There are very few guys who can just lower the temperature, lower the heart rate, and just be completely cool as a polar bear when they step into those high-pressure moments. Ohtani is one of them, and I'm just so glad we finally get to see it. On the flip side, though, on the counter side, Amy, Yu Darvish threw him nothing but breaking balls, off-speed stuff, curveballs, sliders today. Not until that third at-bat could even throw a single pitch over 89 miles per hour. He might have created the formula for how to get Ohtani out moving forward in this postseason.
All right, we'll see with game three to come on Tuesday in San Diego. Are you headed to San Diego for the game?
I am. I'll be leaving tomorrow. I'll be out there for games three and four.
Cool.
And hopefully we'll come back to Dodger Stadium for game five next Friday, or I'll be back at Dodger Stadium next March when they open it up for opening day against the Tigers. So we'll see.
That's how drastically it can change all those postseason plans, not just for you, but for the team. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence, Michael Duarte. A couple more minutes here just to talk about the Rams. Major turning point in their game against the Packers happens early in the second half where they've got the back-to-back turnovers. And, of course, the Packers were able to score those two Tucker Kraft touchdowns. And I know they made it close late, because that's what Matthew Stafford does. But how much are they missing their top receivers in Kupp and Nacua?
Yeah, Amy, we're like Ross from Friends. We're able to pivot, and I like it. the question that you have is, and I'm going to go back to what we talked about, where maybe this is deja vu for the Dodgers in 2022 in the NLDS. This is starting to look like the Rams' 2022 post-Super Bowl season, where the wheels fell off and they went 5-12, the worst season for a Super Bowl champ the following year in NFL history. And it was all due to injuries. If you recall that year, they lost Stafford, they lost Kupp, they lost Aaron Donald, they lost their all entire offensive line. And it's starting to feel eerily reminiscent here again. What I saw for most of the game, and you can look at, you know, they're having red zone troubles. They had it last week against the Bears in that loss. They had it on that opening drive where they had a turnover on downs when they had the ball first and goal from the 4. That was a big issue. Turnovers was an issue. Obviously, you have the Kyren Williams fumble that you mentioned and then the interception on back-to-back drives that led to the 2 touchdowns for the Packers. And even though Jordan Love gifted them that pick 6 at the end of the first half, the first lead, by the way, Amy, the Rams have had in the first half all season, whoa, although they squandered it. But looking at those plays that led to the interception, the fumble, the offensive line is just not protecting and keeping Matthew Stafford up as he needs to be. And when he doesn't have the trust in his receivers, even though guys like Jordan Whittington have stepped up, guys like Tutu Atwell have stepped up, it's not Cooper Kupp. It's not Puka Nacua, as you mentioned, guys he's developed this unbelievable chemistry and trust with. And if you need evidence of that, look no further to that Super Bowl in February of 2022 at SoFi Stadium against the Bengals after Odell Beckham Jr. goes out with an ACL injury. And Bengals are triple-teaming Cooper Kupp, knowing he's the only receiver the Rams have. And Matthew Stafford's out there throwing no-look passes to him. And when the game was on the line, who'd he give the ball to? Cooper Kupp. So he definitely misses this guy. The Rams offense misses this guy. Thankfully, they go into bye week next week. I know they're 1-4. I know things look dire. But if Cooper can come back for that Raiders game, which I believe is the next home game after the bye week, if Puka Nacua can come back, if some of the offensive linemen that are out can come back and keep Matthew Stafford upright, things can turn around quickly. Remember, this Rams team was 3-6 after week 10 last year, and they came back and won 7 of 8 and made the postseason. And we're very close, maybe a pass interference on Puka Nacua away from beating the Lions in that wild card round. So if they can get healthy, they can get hot. They still have a shot, but the wheels can also come off very quickly for the Rams.
Well, before I let you go, though, I want to focus on something you just said about keeping Stafford upright. The guy's 36 years old. I know he's really tough. At times, I feel like he's a superhero out there. The number of hits he takes, and he just keeps on playing. But, man, I mean, they've got to give him some kind of time or keep him from getting hit as often as he is. 3 official sacks, but what, another, like, dozen QB hits in this game? That's a lot for him.
Correct. Yeah, and you hit the nail on the head. Yeah, 3 sacks this week, 3 sacks last week, and I think 5 against the Cardinals the week before. But he's getting knocked down. I'm literally watching him pick himself up off the ground after every passing play. So he's not getting sacked, but he's hitting the turf a lot. And this is a guy who we know is durable. He plays through injuries. But as we saw last week, with the last year when they played the Packers, he missed that game with a finger injury. If he goes out, then it's just complete disaster for the Rams. Now, I know they have Jimmy Garoppolo to back him up. He's a veteran. That's why they went out and got him. But they need to keep him healthy. They need to keep him upright. And they need to get those offensive weapons back ASAP, or they can be in very big, big trouble.
Great stuff on Mike's Twix at Michael J. Duarte from, what is the Dodgers clubhouse, but also Padres talking about what was a very spirited game too that featured plenty of jawing, plenty of extracurricular activity, some fans who forced a delay out there in left field, but it's cool to see these two go toe-to-toe, and the Padres certainly not backing down. So again, find him online at Michael J. Duarte. I feel like normally we talk to you after there's something positive. In this case, it's negative for LA sports fans. But you know what? You wait 24 hours, everything changes again. That's kind of how sports is.
That's definitely how the news cycle works. But something positive, we got to see history with LeBron James and Bronny James on the same court tonight. I know it was a preseason game, but it still is the first time that's ever happened. That's got to be a proud moment. And, you know, once this October baseball is over, we're going to get looking forward to watching Bronny and LeBron play on the court together in a regular season game. And that's going to be really exciting and really fun to watch.
All right, we'll talk then. Yeah, no doubt. That'll be some really sweet history with the entire world paying attention. Thanks so much, Mike, for a couple of minutes. It's good to catch up with you always.
Always good for you, too, and watching all your feeds and the flowers and everything. So keep it up and have a great show, and we'll talk soon.